Love. Some would say it took a backseat when the pandemic forced us apart. As a family-run and proudly Canadian-owned company, Charm Diamond Centers saw the need to bring us together with tales of love and created the Canadian Love Map podcast. Since then, we've shared hundreds of real, uplifting stories that prove love conquers all. So thank you for listening. We couldn't do it without you. And remember, love starts here. What the world needs now is love. More love.
Stars literally aligned.
He's always been the one.
There's someone out there for everyone.
I'm Nancy Regan, your host on the Canadian Love Map. We are on a journey to uncover and share love stories of all kinds.
He's never forgotten to bring me flowers.
We're hoping we're going to give a little good news to this world.
Even in these dark times, the life continues to go on.
It's all about compassion, devotion, adventure, and of course, love.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs love.
This is the Canadian Love Map.
Well, love is the most important thing.
What kept me going in my childhood was reading the works of other people. That's how I knew I wasn't alone. That's how I knew whatever I was going through wasn't that odd, that it was just actually part of the human experience. So if my work can be part of that for someone else, I mean, what could be better?
Today's love story belongs to Jackie Torrens. How do you communicate with the world? Well, today's guest seeks connection through the stories she shares as a filmmaker, actor, and journalist. Jackie is one of Canada's brightest talents. Winning awards for performances on stage and screen, she has directed multiple critically acclaimed feature documentaries and broken glass ceilings as a writer. There's a good chance you've been moved to laughter or tears by her work on screens small and big over the last 25 years. Her creative love letters to the world are informed by a childhood filled with tragedy and an adolescence that forced her to firmly stand on her own two feet. But as you'll hear, Jackie has an inner strength that has propelled her through any obstacle society and fate served up. Today, her life is full of joy, love, and new opportunities to tell us stories in ways only she can. This is the Canadian Love Map. So happy to have you here. I've followed your career, and we live in the same city, and yet our paths have not crossed.
Isn't that wild?
It is. I think you've been avoiding me.
Are we the only two people in this town who have never met?
Yeah. The whole one degree of separation thing? It doesn't work for us, I guess.
No, it doesn't.
We know a lot of people in common.
And true, yeah. It's great that we're meeting today.
This is a podcast about love, and I would like, by starting with that word and almost a word association, in terms of how does love figure in your life right now? What does it mean to you in your life?
Well, it's something really important in my life. It's been hard fought for in my life. So I suppose I would think of that word right off the bat, hard fought for. Mm-hmm. And it's infinite. You know, I've met lots of people where love for them is a really finite thing. And it's not for me. The more love you make, the more love is there. So those are just some initial thoughts that I have off the top about love and its place in my life.
I love that. I have heard of a theory which resonated that what we lacked in our childhood is what we're actually here to teach or to give the world. Does that resonate for you?
Wow, wouldn't that be great? I guess I always see myself as I want to be a student all my life. And I actually am at a place in my life where I've been a student and a teacher in different capacities. Teaching is not ever something I've thought of myself as being, although I have been, you know, a writing instructor and mentored people. I feel like I have spent most of my life trying to learn how to be a loving person and learn what love is and to mitigate the effects of the opposite of love that have come in my life, which everybody has to deal with. So maybe if by example, I've been a good influence on other people, wouldn't that be great to think? But
that's
who knows?
I'm going with that, though, because you had a lack of connection, as I understand it, as a young child and, well, as a child, period, I guess. And now so much of your work is about connection.
Yes. Yeah. I actually get the word empathy is thrown my way a lot when people are talking about my work. I was just having a meeting yesterday about a project I'm working on, and someone very kindly commented on the empathy that the writing seemed to show all the characters, even the less likable characters in the story. And I realized that, yeah, I've had that word thrown at my work a lot over my life, empathy. And that's probably the biggest search I've been on in my own life for, is to see and be seen, to understand and be understood. And story to me, which is my whole life's work, you know, has always felt to me like, you know, it's almost like a SOS code you're sending out to the world. You're creating something and you're sending it out there and you're wondering, does this resonate with you? Will this mean something with you? And when you get an indication back that something you've created has done that for someone else, then yeah, there's the connection right there. So yeah, very astute, Nancy. Yeah, I think I have been searching for a connection all my life, and that is my life's work.
So let's go back and tell me your story so that our listeners understand, you know, the fuller picture.
I guess the word Dickensian is what I might use to describe parts of my upbringing. Although, wow. You know, when I think of what I went through and then in the grand scheme of things of what people go through in life, there are lots of people out there who have gone through lots more difficult things than I've gone through. But
however,
all I can comment on is me and my story and what's happened to me. But yeah, I was my parents, Pat and Barbara. I don't remember my mother. My mother died when I was a baby. I found out years later that actually she was diagnosed with her illness, terminal cancer, when they found out she was pregnant with me, and that the pregnancy with me accelerated the growth of the tumor, and which always made me feel like I had a twin, and the twin that I had was this tumor that was taking my mother's life away as I was simultaneously growing into my own life. And
that's powerful.
It was quite a start. And so when I was born, she had a double mastectomy right away. She was in and out of the hospital right away. And before I was 2 years old, she died. So I have no memory of my mother. And in fact, I didn't even have a picture of my mother and I together until I was in my mid-20s and kind of came across one by happenstance. So my mother growing up was a complete mystery to me. My father remarried very soon after my mother died. I had an older brother and an older sister, and then there was me. And then my father married this woman who brought with her two children. And then a few years after that, my father died. So I was 11 when my father died. By that point, my older siblings had left the house. For the next 3 years, I lived with my stepmother and her two biological children, and that was really difficult. They were a unit, and I was not part of that unit. I ran away a lot when I was 14. I finally successfully was able to leave the home when I was 16.
So you left when you were 16, did you say?
Yeah, I tried to. I ran away. I started working full time when I was 12. No one would give me a paying job. So I actually found a volunteer job at the local hospital. And in the summer times when so school was a safe place for me to go, even though school actually was not a place I liked being at too much, because I actually was a terrible student because of what was going on in my home life. I was failing every single subject, including shop and gym and all the rest of it. But school was still a respite. I would rather be there than at home. And when I wasn't at home, I often hung out at the graveyard that my parents were buried at. In fact, that was kind of like my rec room. So when I wasn't in school, to avoid being at home, I would hang out at the cemetery my parents were buried in. I would bring books and blankets. And I would, in fact, when I was in grade 7, this tough kid in grade 9 singled me out one day. And I took him to my parents' graveyard because I felt like this is what you do when a boy likes you. You take him to your home. And my home was my parents' cemetery. And so the first time I made out with a boy was when I was 12 on top of my mother's grave, because that's where I hung out all the time.
Yeah.
So when I was 12, I found this, the local hospital was taking volunteers, and I loved volunteering so much. I volunteered 40 hours a week for the next 3 summers, but I loved people. I loved meeting people. There were so many different jobs you could do at the hospital. Sometimes you were delivering envelopes. Sometimes you were going to the baby unit and holding babies. Sometimes you were being asked to take something to the psych ward, and that always seemed exciting, like was something going to happen if you were taking something to the psych ward. When I was 14, I ran away repeatedly and no one would hire me. I couldn't get a paying job, so I couldn't find a place to live. So I had to go back. And then when I was 16 and my stepmother told me she was had enough and she was making arrangements to put me in a group home, that's when I decided I would leave for good. And I stayed for a couple of months at my friend's house. I paid rent. I found a fast food job and I paid rent. And then I was asked to leave their home because they couldn't have me there indefinitely. And I moved into a little boarding house that was run by a woman who was 26 years old and let me move in there. She really felt for me. In fact, I still know her now. She kind of acted as my older sister at that time. And I still kind of see her in those terms. Wow. She really saved my life. She gave me a room in this boarding house that was great. It was this giant old Victorian boarding house in the rich end of town. And somehow it was still allowed to be a boarding house at that time. But it still was a really transient environment, like all sorts of people would go through there. And some people who lived there were fine. But sometimes there were people there who were just getting out of jail. And sometimes there were people out of there who were doing, you know, rather dubious things in that building. But there were also people who lived in the boarding house that, you know, were just a bit older than me, and they really were protective of me and kind of took me under their wing a bit. So oftentimes I didn't have a lot of food, and suddenly, you know, someone would be cooking dinner and they would tell me they just happened to have some extra food.
Did Charles Dickens write your life? You're right. I see what you mean when you say Dickensian.
Totally. And then I would get up in the mornings, and I was still trying to go to school. So I would get up in the mornings. I would hitchhike to school because I wasn't allowed to take the bus to school because the school authorities thought I was a bad kid because I lived on my own. So I'd hitchhike to school each day, and then I would go to school, and then I would hitchhike to the pizza place I worked at, and I would work till sometimes 3 in the morning, and then I would come back to the boarding house, and I would get up, and I would hitchhike, and I would try and go back to school. And then eventually I actually had to drop out of school because it was just too hard for me to be hitchhiking, going to school, working. I couldn't keep that up.
So. But it had been important to you to hold that ideal of getting your grade 12?
Well, I came from a middle-class family, so the idea of not having your high school was not something that would be at all supported in the environment I had come from, not even from my dad, who by then was no longer living. I knew that getting my education was important to him. So when I dropped out of school, because again, I was a horrible student, very distracted in school, I decided I was going to write a novel, that if I was dropping out of school, that would be fine, but I was going to write a book. And so I took my last orphan benefits check. I don't even know if they have them now, but there used to be such a thing where if you were that unicorn of a person, an actual orphan, and I always used to laugh at the name of a check that was called Orphan's Benefit. It made me think, what are the benefits to being an orphan? And there actually are some. So I took that last check and I bought a secondhand manual typewriter, and I pounded away on that typewriter until the ribbon broke, and then I didn't know how to fix the ribbon, and then that was the end of the novel. And then I ended up getting knocked up at 17 by a religious fanatic who was 11 years older than me. And I ended up having a child when I was 18 years old. And then when that happened, that's when I really decided, okay, it's one thing for me to drift around and make decisions that are only affecting myself. But now I have this other person here and this other person who wouldn't be here if I hadn't had a hand in creating them. So my responsibility to them is great. So I had better get myself together and get my life started.
You were 18. And you had no family support.
No family.
And you had a baby.
And I had a baby.
That blows my mind. I remember having my first and having tons of support, and all I could think about was single mothers. Yes. All I could think about was, like, I was stressed and overwhelmed, and I would look at my support, you know, structure and think, how do single mothers do it? And I had never really metabolized that before.
Yeah, and so, it is hard. Parenthood, if you have everything going for you, money, support, everything, it is still really difficult. I was never going to have children. So I think I had a child in the only way it was going to happen for me, which was basically to get knocked up at 17 by a religious fanatic. And
I can't help but laugh. It seems strange to laugh when you say that, but...
So in order for me to get my high school, and I had every intention of carrying on to go to university, that because, again, I had come from this middle-class background, and that's what middle-class people do. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to go on to university, and I was going to get my BA. I was going to be a writer. That had been kind of a vocation that had come to me in childhood. And I think that vocation came to me because story was so... affected me so profoundly. Most of us, you know, the first stories we hear are about who we are, our people, who we come from. That really tells us who we are. It gives meaning to our life. I had none of that. So in the absence of knowing my actual story, I think I must have just had this instinctive thing inside that said, I will create story, then I will find meaning through that. I will create story. In order to finish school and then go on to university, I had to go on welfare. So I moved. I was living in PEI at the time. The relationship with my son's father was odd and intense, and actually there was physical violence was part of it. So I left because of that, because I thought one thing for you to harm me, but another thing for you to harm this child. So when I was 18, I moved back over here. I went on welfare. I ended up living in North Dartmouth. So I moved into this one bedroom in North Dartmouth, and I started going to school, doing my grade 12 at Dartmouth High. And it was really interesting. It just so happened to be the same year Dartmouth High that I was going there to finish my grade 12. They opened up a daycare in the high school.
Progressive.
And yet it came under huge scrutiny and criticism from the community at large. There was some people who thought this was a good thing to put a daycare in the high school, and many people, including teachers and the principal of the school, who thought it was a terrible thing, and that it was just going to teach children to go out and get pregnant.
To encourage them. Yeah.
I thought, if anything, the daycare actually had a program where high school kids could come and volunteer at the daycare. And if you want to stop kids getting pregnant, put them in a daycare around actual real babies.
That's birth control.
That is birth control. Totally. So it was a really difficult year. We were in danger of losing that daycare all the time. There was 12 girls. I was one of 12 girls. We were trying to go there to get our education, finish our education. And so I had mixed messages coming at me all the time. You know, there were people who felt like, you know, you slut, you made your bed, you should lie in it. The same people who would complain about having to pay taxes that would go towards income assistance. So they wanted you to stay stuck in this position so that they could keep blaming you for the position that you found yourself in. Mm-hmm. I would have teachers that would, you know, say to me at the end of class, they would take me aside and say things like, we think you are a good girl, but we just don't think this daycare should be there. This daycare allowed me to keep nursing my child through me going to school as well. There was many good things. We could be together. I could go visit him at lunchtime and on my breaks and on the rest of it. So it actually was it was enabling me to get my education. But I remember I took my baby to school one day, and I went in through the front door, and the principal of the school took me aside and said, could you and your baby not come in through the front door because you're a bad example for the other kids?
Oh, gosh.
And he wanted me to go in through the back door. And I was so shocked. And also, I was just a kid. I was 18 years old. I think I said, oh, okay. And then I went home and I thought about it. And the next day, I took me and my welfare baby, and we walked through the front door of the school, and we walked through the front door of the school every day of that entire year after that, because I thought, you're not going to shame me.
Hallelujah, sister.
You will not shame me.
Seriously. You know, you think about the fact that it's the human condition, really, to feel like, very secretly for many of us, I'm not enough. And when you've got people sending you that message from different directions all the time, when you're, you know, struggling as an 18-year-old to bring up a baby. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it was so hard. I ended up being on income assistance for 4 years and actually ended up being able to go to university, which you could do when you were on income assistance at that time. So as hard as life was on income assistance when I was on it, it's even harder now because now there's basically no opportunity for you to go on to post-secondary education, which makes no sense as far as I'm concerned. Out of the 12 girls that went to school that year, we all graduated, and 11 out of 12 of us went on to post-secondary education. But that
seems like a movie right there.
Yeah.
I can see the graduation, yes. The culmination of the film and everything. There could be a feature.
There could be a feature, yeah. And so even though I was so surprised to find myself on income assistance, and I must say the first person's attitudes I had to deal with about what kind of person goes on income assistance was myself, because I had lots of ideas about what kind of person ends up on welfare. Mm-hmm. So I was shocked to find that I actually was one of, you know, quote unquote, those people. And of course, I realized then and understand now that people are people, and sometimes we have circumstances and they lead us to places.
We couldn't share the great stories that we do here on the Canadian Love Map podcast without the amazing support of Charm Diamond Centres. They are Canada's largest family-owned jeweler, and they're proud to be putting love on the map. The folks at Charm Diamond Centres are thrilled to be a part of your love story. So visit charmdiamondcentres.com or one of your local stores. Love starts here. But that would also be a strong set of roots for your empathy as well, to understand what it's like on the other side.
Well, I certainly don't put a lot of value myself in status. So mm-hmm. I can tell you actually, so years later, my first job acting in television was a really fortunate job. It was on a series called Made in Canada.
With Rick Mercer.
Yeah, I had never done anything before. I ended up doing all 5 seasons of the show. I felt so weird about it my first season. I didn't quite know what to do with it, that I volunteered in the mornings with a group that was helping homeless people try to find employment. And then I would go to the studio in the afternoons and do this acting job that I was getting more money for than I had ever made in my life. And I didn't quite know what to do with that. So I balanced it out by trying to do this other work. And in the midst of that, I got an invitation to, we had a friend, my partner and I had a friend, and his girlfriend really wanted to meet me because she loved the show I was on. And that was normally not an invitation I would ever accept, because I've never really been very comfortable with that kind of attention.
Status.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, but as a favor to my friend, I ended up going. I go to this woman's house. Unbeknownst to me, she has invited a dozen of her neighbors over because an actor from that show is going to be in her house. And not only that, she's set up a formal dinner. I thought I was going to meet someone's girlfriend and we'd have a beer and, you know, that would be about it. And she starts telling me about her job. And then at one point, she starts complaining about all the people on welfare who go to the emergency ward and how they're allowed to get taxi chits when they are finished seeing the doctor so they can take a taxi home.
Oh, she didn't know what she was. She didn't know what Pandora's box she was opening.
And I remember she said, you know, it must be nice to get a free ride.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm sitting there as the honored guest at. And I'm thinking, I should probably not say something for my partner's sake, for our friend's sake, for her sake. And then I think, no, I'm going to say something. So I say, you know, when I was on welfare, I don't remember the free fat cat ride you're describing. I remember a really hard life made all the harder by people like you who judged people like me. And
the room went quiet.
Very quiet. And I thank my hostess for the evening, and I got my coat and I left. So I did actually like how status turned on its head that night very much. So yeah, we are all human, and someone's individual character has nothing to do with their status or their economics. And that also we do a lot of assumptions about people with very little investigation. And so that actually features in a lot of my work. I do like to take subjects where people think they have an assumption about And then I like to turn that assumption on its head. So I ended up years later being able to make a documentary about welfare called My Week on Welfare. And I went and I lived with two people who were currently on the system. And I think I spent a week on a welfare budget and living with them. And I think I could only get away with that because I had had the experience of having a half year on the system myself. So it wasn't like I could be a journalist who coming in who was curious about what it might be like to live on income assistance. I knew intimately about what that kind of life is like and how you're treated. And that's part of what made the people who appeared in the documentary trust me.
Of course.
Because it was a huge act of courage for them to go on camera and admit you've been on income assistance and you're going to be in a documentary about this. And not only that, for them to do this documentary, the courage they needed, so much courage, because not only judgment from society at large, but also the real threat of punitive measures from the Department of Community Services.
I would love to go to your son. And you mentioned just the word when you said nursing. You were nursing him when you were in high school and he was in the daycare. And I'd love to go to that connection that you had with this baby, having no recollection of that kind of connection. Obviously, you had some kind of memories that are stored in your cells, but you had no recollection of being nurtured. What was it like for you to start and try to foster that kind of, really important connection with your baby?
Well, before I had my baby, I had already decided long before that I was never going to have children. And I had made that decision because how would I know how to have a child? I had no loving roadmap. The people who would have provided my loving roadmap models of parenthood were dead. One of them I didn't even have any memory of. So much of the early years with my son, Jay, I always have described it as I felt like the blind leading the blind into the desert at midnight. And as you know, the job of parenthood, I think one of the big jobs is that no matter what's going down, no matter what's falling apart, you as the parent, you have to be the calm. You have to be the captain saying, it's fine. I know where we're going. We're going over here. Just follow me. This is where we're going. So I thought a lot, actually, of, do you remember Mary Kay Cosmetics?
Yes.
Yeah.
Pink car and everything.
Yes. Yeah. You could get a pink car
pink
if you
limo,
sold enough makeup. And
pink Cadillac.
Yeah. And the logo of Mary Kay, this woman in the States who created this company, was fake it till you make it. So I thought a lot of fake, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to fake it till I make it. I knew that even if I felt like not at all calm and that I didn't know where I was going, that I had to fake it for this child so this child could feel secure. I think also what was really unexpected was it was so healing. I don't think anyone should have children so that they can heal their trauma. But inadvertently, there were many healing things for me that came out of being a parent. One being, you know, when my child was born and you know that really distinct love that you feel for your child, which is unlike any other love. It's unlike friendship love. It's unlike romantic love. It's unlike love for humanity. You will always do for this person. You will always owe this person. And it's not at all a reciprocal relationship that way. The way you feel about what you owe to them, they certainly don't and shouldn't feel like they owe that to you. They'll feel that for their own children. If
my laughter comes out of the fact that I have three kids.
Yeah.
I get it.
So I was head over heels in love. I couldn't believe how intensely I felt for this child. And then very quickly, the realization that this is what my mother must have felt for me. And so I knew for the first time when he came into this world, how loved I must have been and how healing that was for me.
It's fascinating when you think so many of the adults around you, even teachers and principal, whatever, were shaming you for having made this mistake that was presumably going to ruin your life.
And ruin his.
And ruin his. And yet it changed, like I think of a switcher in a railroad, it kind of changed your whole track of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I swear on this podcast?
Hell
probably.
Yeah.
I got my shit together. Right?
Yes.
Because I had to. So when I went back to get my grade 12, I dropped out and I was going to write my novel and that didn't work out. I don't know if I would have gone back to school if I hadn't had this child. As soon as I had this child, it was like, I better get this together. I went back to school. I graduated. I then went on to university. I took this BA where, talk about orphan benefits. I think if I had had live parents around, they would have been saying, I don't know that you need to study English literature right now. Maybe you need to do something more practical. But one of the benefits of being an orphan is that there's no one there to tell you what you're going to do with your life. So it really is all up to yourself. And I had never questioned that I was going to be studying English literature. I needed that basis for what I was going to do with my life. I needed that information. So when Jay was born, I went back to school and then I went on to university. I didn't even know there was such a thing as the dean's list until I found out I was on it. And then, and all my marks were fantastic when I was in university studying what I truly wanted to study in the first place. So I did great without even intending to. I was just so engaged with what I was learning. A lot of good things came for me having my child. And bless him, I don't think, you know, he hasn't had an easy go of it. It's not like starting the world, entering the world as the child of an orphan teenager is any great shakes. But he loves me. We are close. He's in my life. I'm in his life. I'd like to think, you know, he's an adult now. I think when your kids are adults, my goal was if I can just get to the point where he sees me as a trusted advisor, won't that be great? And that's the position I think I kind of have with him today, which is a miracle because I didn't come from that. So to have a successful relationship with my child, that's wonderful and a miracle. And he has amazing compassion and empathy for me and the circumstances of how he came about in this world, which I'm grateful for.
So in a way, he gave you the gift of connection and also a sense of purpose.
Oh, yes.
And your path shifted. How did it take you further into the world of story as a tool and a purposeful tool?
So in my early 20s, when I was in university, all I was going to do was study poetry. I had no intention of going towards story at all. I thought poetry was the best kind of writing. And I studied under actually a Nova Scotian poet called Don Demansky. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was from Cape Breton. He died just a few years ago. He was had an immensely successful career in poetry. So he had almost 30 years experience under his belt by then. I, by contrast, had no conception of the fact that artists need time to develop. I think maybe in Europe, if you're born in Europe, you have a different idea of artistic development because you're surrounded by art that has literally taken, in some cases, hundreds of years to build. I remember seeing Brunelleschi's dome one time in Florence and realizing it had taken 350 years for that dome to be built, so that Brunelleschi had designed it knowing that he would never see it, his kids would never see it, his grandkids would never see it, his great-grandkids, maybe his great-great-grandkids would see what he had created. That's an entirely different approach to creation than I feel like we have in North America, where there's very little discussion of artistic development, how long artistic development it takes to learn your craft. I think I felt like I should be born genius. I should be born a prodigy. And when it was really obvious I was not a prodigy, that was really tough to deal with. So As much as I learned a ton from Don, and it was a real boot camp for learning metaphor, which is what poetry is really, I also crumbled under the weight of studying with this person who I felt was such a great writer, and with me with no concept of you just have to apply yourself and wait and you might get somewhere there down the road. So I actually ended up having a 3 years block of writer's block while I was working with him. And I didn't think I was ever going to write again. And it was really distressing because, as you say, that had been my entire life's purpose. If I wasn't going to be writing, what was the plan? I had never made any plan B.
Was that pure intimidation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And also just, again, not knowing that, dude, you're 20-something years old. You have a long road in front of you to learn your craft.
You don't have to have it all figured out.
It's not going to happen to you at 22 years old. I mean, even Mozart, you know, when he was writing his little songs on the piano that were blowing people away when he was aged 5, his father had started him at age 2 and they practiced 6 to 8 hours a day every single day. So he had, I don't know how many hours of musical practice under his belt by the time he was starting to write tunes when he was like 5 or 6. No one tells you about the work that goes on behind the scenes.
It's 10,000 hours.
Yeah. So I started after the writer's block. So I came out of the writer's block by basically giving myself 1 year to either make myself some kind of a writer, or if I was going to piss the year away and not do any writing, then I was going to give up on this dream of being a writer and I go get another job, and just it was time to be done with this. And in that year, at the first part of it, I still couldn't write. I was in writer's block. So I told myself I had to be in this study that I had, this room. I had to be in there for 6 hours a day. And if I wasn't writing, I would be reading. And I had to be reading material that was related to what it was I wanted to write.
Wow, that's discipline.
So I started reading all these poets. And then I would often do writing exercises where today it would be like write a poem in the vein of Sylvia Plath, or write a poem in the vein of Mark Strand. So I gave myself my own education that way. But what ended up being written at the end of that year was not poetry, but a play. And it was basically a biographical play about a writer who couldn't write. So I ended up performing that play. And that's how I started writing for theater. And that's how I started acting for theater. And acting and writing for theater is what led to me acting and writing for television.
Mm-hmm. And making documentaries and making story such a big part of your life.
Yeah, documentary only came about 15 years ago. And about 15 years ago, I did radio documentary. And I've only been doing documentary film for the last 10 years. And that's...
Is it a culmination of the other artistic endeavors you've had?
At first, when I left poetry and started writing and acting for theater and then getting into TV, I was really upset with myself. I thought I was not being serious, that I was flitting around from genre or format, and that if I was a really serious person, I would pick one and apply myself to it. But now that I've had so many years of it, I realize the thing that is in common with all of the disciplines I've worked in is story. Mm-hmm. That is the North Star. And it can shift a little. It might look a little different if it's documentary as opposed to, you know, television writing for a show like Trailer Park Boys, which I was the first girl writer for, first and only second of. No easy gig, that one.
That's a whole other episode.
That's a whole other episode. But, you know, story is the thing that has remained consistent. And so to me, documentary is not a culminating thing. Each new genre I go into, I get to be a student again and learn again. So Jessica Brown and I have a company called Pete Media. It's a female-owned production company here in town. And that's where we've done our docs. But we're also now getting into narrative features. And so I have a narrative feature right now in development. So we would like to be narrative and fiction and nonfiction fluid is how I would describe it.
Yeah. Why don't you give an explanation of narrative? What was the expression you used? Sorry, narrative fiction.
Yeah. Well, I guess a fiction story is where things are supposedly made up. And then a nonfiction story is a story taken out of real life. But not in my mind, nonfiction is fiction and fiction is nonfiction. There is truth in both genres. But even nonfiction, you know, like I have writer credits for my documentary films. And sometimes if someone's not in the business, they're like, what do you mean you got a writer credit for a documentary? You're following around real people as they do their real thing. And it's like, yes, I am. But someone at the end of the day has to take that footage and then think of what the beginning is. Yeah. What is the middle? What is the end? What is the arc? What is the rising action? What is the inciting incident? What is the, you know,
you've got to knit it together.
You've got to knit it together. Yeah. Otherwise, if you're just taking, you know, you could just take 6 hours of someone's real life. It's not necessarily a story, you know.
So how does what you're doing now as an actor, as a playwright, as a documentary maker and feature filmmaker, how does it feed your soul?
Feeds my soul tremendously. I think I would be really unhappy if I wasn't doing the work that I have been doing. It gives my life meaning. I'm on a search, you know, and every story I get involved with is because I have a question about something, and it also teaches me something. We're narrative-driven creatures, you know. We will connect the dots even if the dots aren't meant to be connected. We run on story. That's how we learn. That's what keeps us around. And so I pursue meaning over happiness, for sure. Happiness is out of my control. Happiness, like sadness, that will come and go. But meaning is a profound foundation that feels solid to me. And I come from a lot of chaos. So that feeling of solidity feels good to me.
Looping back to connection, how much of your life is informed by your connection to your mother who is gone?
When I was acting in theater, I found out, I ran into a woman who had been a friend of my mother's. And I said, can you tell me anything about her? Because no one will tell me anything. And I know she was a housewife, but was she anything besides that? And this woman said, Jackie, your mother wasn't a housewife. Your mother was an actor. Your mother was a theater actor.
Wow.
And I was already theater acting when I found that out. So anytime I'm doing a play, when I am backstage, just before I'm supposed to go out and do the performance, that's when I talk to my mother. That's when I know I'm in an environment that she was also in, that she was also creative in. So there's that. And then in my mid-20s, my stepmother brought over a box of old papers that had been my mother's. She often kept things of my mother's that I would find out years later. So she brought over this old box. I don't even know why. And she said, these were your mother's. If you want them, you can have them. And largely it was a box of old bills, like old SEER receipts and old resumes. But because I didn't know anything about my mother, it all meant so much to me. Like, oh, she shopped at Sears. I've shopped at Sears, you know, this sort of thing.
Breadcrumbs.
Exactly. Breadcrumbs. In the box was one form that was filled out to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. My mother had been an American. But when she was living with my father in PEI, she had filled out this form and she had checked off 7 prints that she wanted to have sent to her. And in the apartment I was in at the time that I was looking at this piece of paper in my living room were 5 of the 7 prints. I had on my own been attracted to these prints and these artists and put them up on my wall.
You hadn't inherited them.
I had not inherited
them.
No, I went out and got them on my own. Wow. And then sometime after that, found this paper and found that I had 5 of the 7 prints that she had wanted to have. And in that moment, I realized I knew my mother, that my mother was a part of me, and that I knew her in a profound way. So that was also really healing. But I have a very loving parental voice in my head that I have always had. And I think, I'm not sure where that came from, but I suspect it came from her and also my father.
And not prying into your sense of spirituality, but do you feel like your mother is walking through the world with you?
I think when you're an orphan, you get to think whatever the hell you want to think. And so if I have a day where I need to think that and it makes me feel better, I think it.
You go, girl.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you when you create a story that holds a mirror up for someone else, and you hear from them what it means to them? You know, maybe a stranger reaches out to say, this is what this piece of art that you created has meant to me in a very deep and meaningful way.
Oh my gosh, the chance to alter in a positive way anyone's life. I mean, I know how I feel when other people have done that to me and other people's work has done that for me. I mean, the fact that art, it takes the pain of life and it's an alchemy, you know, it turns it into, it's like in fairy tales, wasn't it, Rapunzel, where the guy takes the old hay and spins it into gold. I mean, isn't that what art is doing? It's kind of taking the pain and the trauma of our life and elevating it and making it something else so that someone else can look at it and go, yeah, me too, or even I didn't know that that was your experience and now I understand that experience. So yeah, it's an empathy builder for sure. I mean, that's what kept me going in my childhood was reading the works of other people. That's how I knew I wasn't alone. That's how I knew whatever I was going through wasn't that odd, that it was just actually part of the human experience. So if my work can be part of that for someone else, I mean, what could be better?
I can't get better than that. We can't go anywhere that will take us to a better place than that. That's a beautiful sentiment on which to end. And I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. That's so kind of you. It's been great to be here.
Thanks so much for listening to the Canadian Love Map. This podcast is presented and made possible by Charm Diamond Centers. It's hosted by me, Nancy Regan, and is produced and distributed by Podstarter. We love sharing love stories of all kinds, and that could include yours. So do you or someone you know have an uplifting tale to tell? Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram using @CanadianLoveMap or email producer@podstarter.io. We'll be back next week with another love story to add to the map.